trying to piece together words and phrases, if you will, that give sort of the narration of our life together as people who are called New Cumberland Church of the Nazarene. We are endeavoring to create documents that serve us as parameters and narration for a life well lived in light of the will of God for us in this time. We have been given a part of a story. Thank you, Ben. We've been given so many years to write a story here on the corner of 16th and Brandt. Here in New Cumberland on the West Shore, Mechanicsburg. I'm beginning to learn my way around after being here for a year. I'm still not sure when I move from Lemoyne to New Cumberland or when Mechanicsburg actually begins. I haven't figured that out quite yet, but they tend to all sort of go together, but I'll figure it out. I do know when I'm in Harrisburg. I know, you know, on the other side of the river. And I do go over there quite a bit. But I'm getting distracted. Here's my point. We are trying to give language to sort of, again, give us focus, common practices, things that we hold in common that we expect of one another as people who are learning the way of Jesus together. And that is our very simple mission statement. We are people whose mission it is to learn the way of Jesus together as we invite others to join us at his table with us. The table being the central metaphor of the warmth of Christ's presence in our lives. Our sign says it. There's a place at the table for you, creating space. So that's what we're doing. I'm talking about our common practices. There in your worship folders, worship guides. One of these days I'll figure out what I want to call this. I don't want to call it a bulletin. I know you all call this a bulletin because you've been calling this a bulletin all your lives, all right? It's not a bulletin, okay? Bulletin has information, okay? This is a worship guide it's a spiritual formation tour, okay? A tool. Say that with worship guide. Would you say that phrase with me? Worship guide. This is a worship guide. Now, I know this is weird. I get it. I get that learning language is weird. One of the things I've noticed about this church is our disagreement in what we call things around here. What's that building across the way? I don't want to get into it right now, all right? What's that big room down there, all right? Okay. The reason language is so important is because language shapes culture. And we are trying to create a sort of a cultural narrative, if you will, this way of understanding life together. And language is so integral to understanding that. That phrase we're going to talk about today, attending the means of grace. I would love for that to become a part of our language here in our community. Anyway, so here in the worship guide, we have on the back this statement, which is our mission statement and our common practices. I don't see our mission statement on here. Becky, we need to make sure that it's on the back. Oh, we need to make that much larger, but we can deal with it. We don't have to work on that now. Okay. Anyway, and this is kind of the series I'm going through right now. These four common practices. Today, we're talking about the second common practice: the expectation that people who are part of this story are growing people. But before that, we have a question. Question there at the top of the third panel over, which is simply this. I never pray because I don't see the point. I'm not sure why you would be here if you're number one, but I never pray because I don't see the point. Or 10, I pray all day, every day without fail. Prayer is like breathing to me. Where would you place yourself on that spectrum? I don't get it. And you know what? You could be here and be a number one, honestly. I understand that. I mean, why do we need to tell God? If God already knows what we need, why we need to talk to God, right? Okay. So if you're one, that's all right. I'm not going to besmirch your position. So one, I don't get it. Don't do it. Never have. I won't, even if I'm a foxhole, even on my deathbed, not going to pray, not going to happen, okay? And 10 is, it's like breathing to me. It is constant, all right? So let's go low and go high, and we'll go high. Go from low to high. 1, 2s, and 3s. Any 1, 2s, and 3s? I don't get it. Don't do it. Okay, that's kind of usually we have someone. Albert's not here today. That's what it is. Okay. Four, five, and six. 4, 5, and 6. Somewhere in the middle. Okay, I'm with you. I understand. 7, 8, 9s. Look at you, 7, 8, 9s. Okay, all right. And 10s, any 10s? All right, very good. Breathing, cool. I need to get with you, honestly, because, and I'm being serious. I mean, there are some folks who have gifts for prayer, and if we're going to be an apprenticing church, we need to find those people and let them do some apprenticing, in all honesty. Okay? So, good. Yeah, thanks for that response. Let's listen to the scriptures together, as our forebears have done down through the centuries. I think I want to read just from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6. I'm just going to read 1 through verse 8. Let us stand for the reading of the scriptures. Matthew chapter 6, 1 through 8, Jesus says this. He says, "Beware of practicing your piety before others in order to be seen by them, for then you have no reward from your Father in heaven. So whenever you give alms or give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that they may be praised by others. Truly I tell you, they have received their reward. But when you give alms, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your alms may be done in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. And whenever you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and at street corners, so that they may be seen by others. Truly I tell you, they have received their reward. But whenever you pray, go into your room and shut the door and pray to your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. When you are praying, do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think that they will be heard because of their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask." So, God, we now do what millions of Christians have done, will do, and will be doing this day around the world, gathering around the scriptures and listening again to hear your Spirit speak, listening again so as to be formed in the way of Jesus, filled with the Spirit of Jesus, loving in the way of Jesus. Give us eyes to see. Give us ears to hear. Give us the courage to obey. In Christ's name. Amen. You may be seated, everyone. I admire people who can make things with their hands. I admire them for many reasons, and one of the reasons being that is that so much of my work that I do is accomplished through words. Words that are thought in my head, written on a computer screen, and then spoken in this very moment. What I'm doing right now is speaking words that I had thought up and written on a computer screen. And for the most part, I'm okay with that. I'm at peace with my vocation. At least I better be. I've been doing it for 23 years. I've come to understand that the things I make happen to be sermons. Those are the things I make week after week. Written documents serving this spoken word moment. Now, I'd like to think that there is an aesthetic quality, maybe a certain beauty to some of the sentences I compose. But still, the things that I make are rather cerebral in nature, fleeting, here for a moment, then gone the next. See, I admire people who can take the raw materials of our world and create from them things that are both beautiful and functional. I appreciate, for example, Pat Carney's work with what he does with wood, taking the raw material of wood and creating beautiful things, or taking the raw material of venison and making jerky. He does that well, too. See, I was the son of a craftsman. My dad sustained our family's life through the work of making things from metal. He was a machinist. He ran machines that cut metal to make objects that had to be so precise that they were measured within a thousandth of an inch in variance. My dad worked with tools called calipers. Anyone know what a caliper is? A caliper, they're tools designed to measure for people who make things with very exacting standards of precision. Now, my dad learned the fundamental works of his trade in high school. And then he went to work in a small machine shop in Columbus, Ohio. Dietmar Hoheisel was the name of the shopkeeper, the machinist. My dad apprenticed there, learned his trade, practiced making things, and then spent the rest of his life making things for a living. My dad likes to make things. As a hobby, he was a skrimshander. Probably not many of you know what a skrimshander is. A skrimshander is one who puts tiny little scratches on polished cow horns, fills in those scratches with ink, thus creating beautiful images and scenes. And these cow horns were used years ago to hold black powder for muzzle-loading firearms. He occasionally sold his work, but because he hated marketing and he hated being away from my mom for any length of time, he only sold a few of them. Hey, he was quite good at it, really good at it, until a stroke took away his abilities. It took him many hours to perfect his craft, and one of my prized possessions is the powder horn he gave me upon my high school graduation. It still has, if you go in, my powder horn is actually in my study, and if you open it up and you pour it, there's still trace amounts of black powder, because it wasn't just for show, it was for blow. It was that I carried it with me in the hills of South Central Ohio over my shoulder with the muzzle-loading flintlock rifle that he had made for me as well, which was stolen years ago. Another very sad story. Now, let me talk to you about flintlock for a second. I have no idea. We'll see if these stories end up anywhere, all right? But I used to, with that flintlock Kentucky rifle that he made with me, I used to compete at the state level, in the state of Ohio, as a youth, all right? And now, if you don't know what a flintlock is, it is the kind of firearm that was used back in the day when America was fighting for its independence from the British Empire, okay? Flintlock. It was called a flintlock because the hammer actually held a piece of flint. And when you pulled the trigger, the hammer came down, hit what was called a frizzen, a piece of metal, opened up the frizzen, and shot sparks into a little pan that was holding a very finely granulated black powder called 4F black powder, okay? Now, that powder in the pan would explode. A little puff would go off, and that fire would travel through a tiny little hole in the breech or the end of the barrel, and it would travel through the little hole, and then it would explode the larger charge of black powder that was sitting behind a round lead ball that was sent out of the rifle with riflings, spinning the ball and sending it forth at a tremendous velocity and with tremendous accuracy. Flintlock muzzle-loading rifle had to be loaded through the muzzle. The Kentucky long rifle was the sniper weapon of its day. Lethally accurate. Now, if you practiced enough, if you learned to control your breath, so much of it was about breathing, if you learned to control your breath and squeeze through the shot as you brought the bead down on the target, breathing and moving at the same time and squeezing. If you did it at just the right time, you brought all of those different factors together, the gun would discharge. A small explosion would go off about an inch or two from your face, and then it would send the ball to the target. I practiced as a young kid. I was young and fit and pretty good shot. I've got some trophies that would prove that I was a pretty good shot. Now, I admire people, and I think this is where I'm going. I admire people because of diligent efforts and practice who make beautiful things or who are able to perform under pressure with confidence and competence. Musicians know of what I mean. I also spent hours upon hours in a conservatory of music playing a trumpet in a little tiny room all by myself trying to become good as a musician. Artists know what I mean. Athletes know what I mean. And I want to suggest that Christians, followers of Jesus, should know what I mean as well. For Christians are people who are committed to creating a beautiful life of holy virtue, learned in an apprenticeship with Jesus within the context of a community. And this requires the rituals and the routines, the holy habits of a long obedience in the same direction if you're going to live life in the way of Jesus, a long obedience in the same direction. Now, we chose, as I've mentioned, we chose the language of common practices rather than core values, in part because core values, in my mind, are too cerebral for the formation of Christian virtue. I've just known too many people who claim to value some things about God whose life do not confess the truth of that confession. Do you know people like that? I know there is a gap. I know there's a gap between what we say we believe and how we act. I get that, and I understand that grace is in the gap. But here's my concern. My concern is that we move into the language of common practices, the habits and the routines, the practical piety of the Christian life, and that we practice them with a diligence that actually begins to form in us the life and way and character of Jesus. So we chose the language of common practices over the language of core values. Common practices is the language of learning through apprenticeship, through doing, through repetition and reverence, through piety and practice, through a long obedience in the same direction we learn. We learn the way of life that pleases God. We learn the way of life embodied in Jesus of Nazareth. This can't be accomplished without practice, without holy habits, without ritual and routine. I'm not afraid of the word ritual. I think ritual is an absolutely fundamentally wonderful and beautiful word, and that the holy habits and rituals of our lives conspire, if we allow them, to mitigate the grace of God or to mediate the grace of God in such a way that we begin to, unbeknownst to ourselves, live more fully in the way of Jesus through ritual and routine and holy habits. Long obedience in the same direction. See, this way of Jesus cannot be accomplished alone. We learned that last week. We learned last week that one needs a community to learn to live in a world in which God is king. Because the world is living in a world out there is not living in the world in which God is king. We are called to live in a world in which God is enthroned in Christ. And by this life we live, bear witness to his enthronement over the world. Stanley Hauerwas, one of the great theologians of our day, says, and I quote, "What is needed is a training in the habits necessary for the acquisition of the virtues." I love that quote. I think it's in your worship guide. Habits necessary for the acquisition of the virtues. Such training requires apprenticeship to a master who has gained the wisdom necessary to gauge our failures and our successes, and also requires membership in a community that can direct us to the goods correlative to the virtues. And yet, he adds, Christians are not called to be virtuous, they are called to be disciples. And my take on that is, Christian virtues are defined by the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, serving as our atonement, our atonement with God, but also serving as the model for our way of living in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Now, last week, we talked about our first common practice, summed up in the phrase, we gather. We gather to worship on Sundays more often than not. We gather in smaller groups to learn, to connect and grow. We create hospitable space for one another. The notion of hospitable space, I think, is so key because it is essential that we create space for one another to join us in following Jesus, in learning a ministry. Just like my dad learned to be a machinist in Dietmar's machine shop. I mean, if we do not create hospitable space among us, then how can others apprentice with us? Our second common practice is simply we grow. We are a growing people, meaning, clarifying statement is next, says, we attend daily to the means of grace. Now, you can think of the means of grace like Dietmar's old machine shop, a place to learn trade. In one corner is a lathe and someone there to help you learn how to use it. Another corner is a mill with someone to help you learn how to use it. But in this shop, we have over here people who will help you learn the way of generosity, enabled by fiscal discipline. Others will help you practice loving difficult people. The church is really good at helping you love difficult people because there's always plenty of difficult people in the church. That was a joke. Anyway. Actually not. It wasn't a joke, wasn't it? Hey, you laughing? You didn't laugh because it's not a joke. All right, but on. There are others who will help you take your educational gifts, for example, and hone them to tell stories of our faith in a compelling voice to our children and to young adults and to our adults. We have musicians here who will help you take your musical gifts and use them in service of church, of the worship of the church. They'll teach you how to begin to perform for an audience of one in Christian corporate worship. And then over here, imagine with me, there is this other corner of very special people who will teach us that which is fundamental to the practice of the Christian faith. These folk will teach us a new language. See, you have to learn a new language if you're going to be a Christian. And I'm not talking about just not using swear words anymore. I'm talking about this language that all Christians must become fluent in. You may have not known that you have to learn a language when you became a Christian, but you do. And the language is simply called prayer. Prayer is a language of dependency on grace. The scholar Dr. Eugene Boring says that, quote, prayer is the language of confession. By confessional language, he says, I do not mean merely admitting that we have done wrong, but confession in the sense of expressing faith, the language that gives expression to our deepest convictions. The believer asks for bread neither to inform God of a need nor to persuade a reluctant deity to supply it, but to confess our own need before God and to declare dependence upon God. See, if one is to learn the way of Jesus, the first of many lessons will be about learning the Christian language of prayer. Now, I'm going to say something that's going to sound a bit like the tactics of pastoral coercion here for a moment. It's not meant to be that, but it will sound that way. But it is also the truth, I think, and here it is. The truth is that the best way to kill attendance at a Christian gathering is to call it a prayer meeting. Isn't that interesting? You want to see the attendance go down here on Sunday mornings? Let's just start calling it a prayer meeting. Now that'll do it. That'll do it. Our spiritual formation team and I are planning Wednesday night gatherings during the Lenten season, the 40-day journey to Easter. And it will be essentially a prayer gathering. That is, the main event will be prayer, praying through a psalm, for example, that will be the text for the following Sunday. And the details are still in the works, and Jeff and his team are working on it in collaboration with myself. But we will be, I think, using the historic Christian faith to give us the order of the gathering, because we'll be praying together from the office of the daily prayers, the morning, noon, evening, and nighttime prayers. We'll be praying the evening prayers. They're called the Vespers from the Book of Common Prayer, which is one of the places that the church has gone for centuries to learn the language of prayer in the scriptures, and all this will be explained in due time. The prayer gathering will include perhaps a little bit of music, maybe a Taizé song. I'm going to introduce a Taizé song today during the piece, but the main thing will be prayer. And I wonder, will the church gather in the middle of the week on a Wednesday night to learn the language of prayer? Our second common practice is simply we grow. And our clarifying statement is we attend the means of grace daily. And then we give examples. We attend to the presence of God through scripture reading and meditation, prayer on behalf of others and on myself, breath prayers. We talked about breath prayers, spiritual reading and study. And the list goes on and on of the means of grace that we can attend, because attending the means of grace refers to the activities and context through which God mediates God's grace to us. We place ourselves in a posture that God can get at us. That's what I mean when I say attending the means of grace. And it is a language that comes out of our Wesleyan tradition, which I think it's a part of our identity, that we are people who know that we are not going to stumble into holiness, we're not going to stumble haphazardly into living a beautiful life, that will be done in cooperation with God, who is always pouring grace upon our lives. But if God is pouring grace upon our life, showering us with his grace, and we've got our umbrellas up, we're not going to get wet. Attending the means of grace is taking the umbrella down and getting our buckets out. Attending the means of grace. Lots of buckets in the Christian narrative to help you with that. It's always raining. It's always raining. And there's lots of different buckets to use. Some that you will like and you will embrace, and others that perhaps won't suit your personality type. It doesn't matter. What matters is that you are tending the means of grace daily as you're pursuing the way of Jesus. See, if you're a part of this church's story, we're going to have some expectations for you that are life-giving, by the way. And the expectation here is that we are all attending the means of grace daily, and we're finding relationships that promote growth, and maybe we have a person or two in our life who has the privilege and the right to ask us if indeed we are attending the means of grace daily. We got some pushback in our church meeting about that word accountability, which is really interesting, because that's part and parcel of what it means to be Wesleyan Christians. It means that we have relationships that promote growth. Have you gotten your bucket out? Have you been catching some of that rain this week? That's accountability. If not, why not? And how can I pray with you toward that end? We attend to relationships that promote growth. If you're part of this church's story, you'll be encouraged, you'll be pressed, hopefully inspired to attend the means of grace daily. We learned from our ME25 survey that 63% of our people don't attend the means of grace daily. A large number do, but 63% gave us a 4 or lower, and a 4 or lower means most often, but not every day. We are going to do all we can to equip and support and encourage you in the practice of the means of grace, in the myriad of ways that grace can be attended to on a daily basis, so as to help you nurture your faith, to live robustly and beautifully when no one's watching, when no one's watching. Now, in our text for today, Jesus warns his first disciples about practicing their piety in the forms of prayer, in giving to the poor, and in fasting. We didn't read that part, but those are the three sort of bedrock foundational practices of piety that Jesus deals with in this teaching. And they are in prayer, almsgiving, which is giving to the poor, and in fasting. Fasting came later after he offered the Lord's Prayer as the model for our praying life. Jesus tells us that he warns his first disciples about practicing our piety in the form of prayer, giving to the poor, and fasting like the religious professionals did, that is, using prayer as performance art so as to impress others. It's Jesus' warning. Jesus tells us if you do this, if you pray elaborate prayers to impress others, if you give money to the poor in order to appear holy, if you fast in order to gain admiration from your peers, Jesus says you've received your reward. You've received it. In other words, the means of grace, the activities of piety, is about nurturing one's relationship with God so as to be prepared to live in God's future heaven on earth world. The future world that is coming when heaven and earth are joined together in seamless union, which is the great hope and desire of everyone who follows Jesus, because it's what Jesus' life was all about, inaugurating that world. That's our reward. That's our reward. There's a reward that all followers of Jesus long for. It is the reward of God's heavenly agenda being established in fullness throughout all of the earth. That's why Jesus, in the middle of his prayer, told us to pray, "Your will be done." Where? On earth, as it is done in heaven. For we learn the way of prayer and generosity to the poor and detachment from creature comforts like food to be better prepared to live into God's future reign. That being our reward. But if you do religious things like praying and fasting and giving to impress others, to garner the favor of others, then the only reward you get is the affirmation of those who cannot see your heart. But the one who can see your heart is not impressed. When I was a kid, back to the flintlock, I don't know why this, but okay. When I was a kid, a teenager, I learned how to place a round lead ball from the firearm I was shooting, because it wasn't a bullet, it was a round lead ball. I learned to place a round lead ball in a tiny, which was about the size of a marble, in a tiny black circle about yay big at 25 yards without a rest. Not all the time, not perfectly, but often. Often I learned to do that. Occasionally, I was able to shoot that round ball, and I did this, and this is very hard to do. We would place an axe head with the sharp end facing us. And either side of the axe head, we would place two clay pigeons, about this big around, on either side of the axe head. And the idea was to shoot the round ball 25 yards at the axe head, split the round ball, and break both pigeons. Okay? It can be done. I've seen it, and I've done it. You just have to believe me.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not you believe it or not, I have seen it done. Now, this was due, obviously, to a commitment to practicing focus. Focus on a target. The distraction of the recoil, which was very small, really. The distraction of the report of the rifle, the sound of the rifle going off. The distraction of the little explosion going off your face, just inches from your face. You could be so focused on the target that you did not see that happening. You just ignored all of those things. It was all about breathing and squeezing and shooting through the discharge of the firearm to the target. Nothing else mattered but that target. That's the only way you could hit it. This, of course, took a lot of practice. This took repetition. This took missing the mark more often than not. It took being willing to fail many, many times until proficiency was gained. Now, understand, brothers and sisters, we are not talking about earning one's way into heaven by gaining proficiency in our acts of piety. That's not what we're talking about. We believe that salvation is by grace alone through faith, and that of itself, it is a gift of God. Got that. We get that. That is absolutely foundational. We're talking about, though, we're not even talking about heaven and hell here. Those are God's domain. What we're talking about here is learning a very, very beautiful way of living in this world called Christianity. That's what we're talking about. A way of seeing the world, a posture of being in the world. So the question becomes, what happens when our sole desire is God's pleasure? What happens when that's the only target that matters? What happens to our acts of piety, our religious observance? When our life is a performance for an audience of one, what does that life look like? Now, see, we intend to be a community that promotes growth in the individuals that join our story. We are really here to help individuals grow. That's why we had the Strength Finders seminar yesterday, which was really a great time of self-awareness and learning about ourselves and our talents that are becoming strengths. We are committed to that, and we're going to offer these kinds of things more often. We're probably going to do it. I'm in the beginning talks of offering emotional intelligence training here. So essential to growing human beings. Why? Because we're really interested in investing in every person in this church towards growing, providing context. We can't make you come. We can only provide the context for you to attend to. We tend to be a community that promotes growth in individuals that join our story. Growth in the knowledge and love of the Lord, growth in grace, growth in love, growth in maturity and emotional intelligence, growth in wisdom. All of these and so much more are the fruit of a life lived into the glory of God alone. Even attending the means of grace will be for nothing if our practices are offered to serve the purpose of diminishing our guilt or making others think well of us. When my family and I were in Paris at the end of our sabbatical now 3 years ago, we were privileged to see a collection of Van Gogh paintings. It was the largest collection I'd ever seen in one place. The colors were incandescent. And it was, honestly, one of the most powerful spiritual experiences I've ever had outside the context of Christian corporate worship. That and a U2 concert, those two, okay? But you go to a U2 concert, I'm telling you, you will understand, all right? But anyway. The beauty was breathtaking. Breathtaking. I couldn't believe I got to be there to see this art. tears welling up in my eyes as I was just going around the room gazing at art. First of all, I thought I'd ever have a chance to see in the flesh, but then to see so many beautiful pieces of art in one room. And how was such beauty possible? That was the question that welled up within me. How was such beauty possible? Well, just hours of putting globs of paint on a canvas. Obsessing with work and color and color combinations, a willingness to put globs of paint on a canvas in such a way that no one had ever seen before and look at it cross-eyed like, what's that, Mr. Van Gogh? Vincent, what are you doing there? Willingness to withstand some criticism because he was doing things that no one had ever seen before. People didn't just understand what this was, but what it was and what it is beauty that transcends the test of time. We learned in our Strength Finder seminar yesterday that of the 34 signature strengths, talents that God gives us that are found in human experience, the odds of any two people having the exact same order from 1 to 10 or from 1 to 34 it is so astronomical as to be implausible for anyone to share the same order of the strengths, even in the top 10. There are more people on earth than that makes that statistically possible. So in other words, there's no one like you. There is no one like you. God has created you utterly unique, utterly beautiful, and desires to pull forth from you this beauty that's within you. Now, but it won't happen by accident. You'll need to grow, and that grow will require ritual and routine, piety and practice, a focus on living to the glory of God alone and attending the means of grace toward God's glory. At the end of his great works, Johann Sebastian Bach wrote three letters, S-D-G, Soli Deo Gloria, to the glory of God alone. We gather, we grow, we give, we go to the glory of God alone. Amen? May it be so. May it be so.